Lecture 5, Mysticism in the 12th Century.
Welcome to Lecture 5. In Lecture 4, I provided a kind of overall view of what mysticism is. I should add that mysticism, of course, is the locomotive of religion. Without these testimonies of religious people being one with God, religion becomes essentially a social setting. Mysticism is intrinsic to religion and the most important part of religion. And in some respects, without it, there would be no religion. It would become essentially voyages to Atlantic City, to Las Vegas, bingo games, and the kind of social ways in which religions work. It is because there are all these people who claim that they are mystics, that they could see the face of God, that in a sense religion has its charismatic and magical aspects. On the other hand, mystics are always in a kind of liminal place between heresy and orthodoxy, and which is why it is very important to realize that some of the people whom we call mystics in a different setting would have been called heretics. And we are going to explore that when we get to heresy later on in this series of lectures. What I want to do here today is to look at two mystics in the 12th century. I want to look at Hildegard of Bingen, one of the most important female mystics of the 12th century. And I also want to look at Bernard of Clairvaux, who is probably the most important mystic of the central Middle Ages, certainly the most important figure of the 12th century. And I want to point out to you that in Christianity, within the Christian religion, there are mystics from very early on. I already mentioned Paul, the Apostle Paul, as one of those who has something close to a mystical experience on the road to Damascus. Augustine of Hippo is another example of early mystics. There is a tradition of mysticism, and we have literary evidence for these mystical experiences up to around the 6th century. And from the 6th century until the 12th century, there is very little evidence, or at least to say there's very little evidence that is articulated in writing, that is a historical source, which we can look at because it, in many respects, it parallels the decline of European civilization after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West and the social and economic context in which religious figures lived. So there is very little going on in terms of a mystical experience until the 12th. And when we arrive in the 12th century, there is an incredible proliferation of mystics. Mystics are everywhere, and I could spend the entire 24 lectures discussing mysticism in the 12th century. People like Richard of St. Victor, Hugh of St. Victor, Midgard of Midhild of Midberg, all kinds of different important mystics, female and male alike, and I am going to discuss only two of them. And I want to point out to you as well that this mystical experience empowers women, empowers people who otherwise would have had no power, so that historically the fact that their ideas were accepted by the church and embraced by the church, and that they will in fact be praised and privileged within Christianity and within their own communities because of their visions, because of what they say, because of what they saw and experience, will provide these people with a platform that they will otherwise not have. So, with that introduction, let's look at Hildegard of Bingen. Born around 1098, at the very end of the 11th century, she lived until 17th September of 1179. She had a very long life, and essentially not unusual for the Middle Ages, where people, if they go after a certain age, they could have very long lives, but a long life indeed. We know that she comes from a quite aristocratic family, that her family has large estates in the area of the Rhineland, in the area of Bingen. We know that very early in life she is sent to a monastery, that she joins a monastery, that she's a member of the high nobility. We know that she has ties with the powerful people in the land. She is an active letter writer. She wrote more than 300 letters to the emperor, to Frederick Barbarossa, to Bernard of Clairvaux, about whom I will say something later on, and to all kinds of other dignitaries in the land. She is a woman who has a place in society, and that place in society is granted to him to her mostly because of her mystical claims. We know also that she's an educated woman. That is why she writes. But it's not that she writes and reads, but that she writes and reads on a variety of subjects. We know that she is a scientist and that her medical works are of great importance and are read by other doctors, that she discusses herbal cures, healing, and that her works are read widely throughout the West. So here we have an important woman, a woman who is educated in a century in which very few women are. It's a woman who intersects, her life intersects and parallels that of other important women of the 12th century, that of Eleanor of Aquitaine, of whom she is a contemporary, and also Eloise, the mistress of Abelard, one of the most learned women in the West in this period. We know that she enters a monastery of Disibodend and that she is elected prioress in 1136, not only because of her piety, but also because of her aristocratic connections. And we know that together with other nuns, in 1147, she goes and founds a new monastery, the monastery at Bingen, where she will reside for the rest of her life. We know that she is indeed the abbess of the monastery and that she rules the monastery with great insight and that she is indeed a good and faithful and mystical nun. We know she's also a musician and she composes music which plays a very important role in her mystical experiences. The music of Hildegard has become exceedingly popular in the last 10 or 15 years, mostly because she's seen as a feminist, and I will talk about that later on in great detail, but it is very beautiful music indeed, and the themes of this music, the many compositions that she has, had to do with the Virgin Mary, with the thousand virgins, with the martyrs of the church, and all that, and it is exquisite music, and I wish I could play some of it for you here. But what interested me most about Hildegard and her role in society and the role of her mysticism in society in this period is the manner in which Hildegard takes a position which is quite novel, and it reflects a great deal in many respects what is taking place in terms of the cult of the Virgin and courtly love. It is Hildegard who is the first one to ambition Eve and Mary and the role of women in the church. Well, we know a great deal about Hildegard. We know through the work of Caroline Bynum, a scholar at Columbia University, who wrote a tremendous book on Holy Feast and Holy Fast, and another book on Jesus as Mother. And through the work of Bynum, we can enter into the particular spirituality of women in the 12th century, in the spirituality of these women mystics. And I quote from Hildegard of Bingen. That is to say, there is a vision that she has, and she sees Christ on the cross, bleeding from his side, from his left side, from the piercing of the lance of a Roman soldier, and there is a stream of blood pouring out from his wound, and there is Mary holding a chalice, and the chalice being filled with the blood of Christ. And she hears a voice that says to her, "Eat and drink the body and blood of my Son, to abolish the prevarications of Eve and receive your true inheritance." In many respects, what we're really talking about here is a dramatic transformation, of which I hinted at in Courtly Love, which is also reflected in the work of Hildegard of Bingen. Meaning by this, that the normative text about the role of women in the people of the book, the religions of the book, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is that second story of creation. That is to say, there are two stories of creation. One, which are found in the book of Genesis. One, a very simple one, which says that God created man, male and female, he created them. And the second one is a very complicated story, the ones that becomes normative, the text that is really quoted and in a sense used throughout the period that follows the writing of Genesis. And that is, of course, a story which we are all familiar with, the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve out of Adam, woman out of man, in the old Celtic language. And in a sense, women become subordinated to man. And not only woman becomes subordinated to man, but Eve is seen as the one who, in a sense, leads Adam into temptation and leads to the fall of man. That terrible sin, that terrible moment in which we are banished from paradise. And for Hildegard and for all the female mystics of the period, in a sense, what you have here is that Mary, in the moment of incarnation, in a sense, cancels that debt which mankind holds from females. Cancels that debt by being the vessel in which the Lord is incarnate. And so, in a sense, here we have eat and drink the body and the blood of Christ. Why? Because many of these female mystics of the 12th century engage in an extraordinary fastings in punishing the body. That is the holy fast. That is to say, they purge themselves, they purify their bodies by continuous purging of themselves. But at the same time, they receive a different kind of food. And that tell us, is a sign to us of the way in which the host, communion, transubstantiation, comes to play a greater role in medieval society in the 12th century. You are fed from the body of Christ. You are fed from the blood of Christ. You take communions in two forms, and that way you live on. And we have story after story of mystics who will eat no food at all, but only who will eat the body of Christ and the blood of Christ, that they will be sustained by this spiritual food that is given to them. And it is Mary who, in a sense, fills the chalice and offers it to mankind. Christians who eat the God together, in a sense, save mankind. Humankind is saved by this sacrificial moment in which the body and blood of Christ is eating as a community, and it is being offered by a woman who indeed leads in the fasting and leads in the feast. It was Hildegard who also in her medical works argues for the different but equal contributions of men and females to conception. Understand this, until the 12th century, the old classical idea about reproduction remains alive and important. It is an issue which goes back to the Greeks and which Jews and Christians have embraced as well, which is that it is the semen of man that has life in it, that the woman is nothing but a vessel, something that in many respects serves as a receptacle for conception, but that the woman contributes nothing to the act of conception. This is an issue which had been decided in ancient Athens and we see in Aeschylus, in the Oresteia, in the stories about Orestes. Orestes, who have killed his mother, flees the Furies and goes to the Areopagus in Athens. And there at the Areopagus in Athens, he comes to the Areopagus and they determine that it is the semen of man that has the principle of life and that women are essentially nothing but a passive receptacle. And therefore, he is not to be punished by the Furies for the slaying of his mother. And here in the 12th century, in one of her medical works, Hildegard argues, rejecting this classical tradition, that all the Old Testament and the classical tradition views of semen and pollution and not of the pollution of men are incorrect. And she points out, in fact, that Eve is a true human. Because after all, Adam is made of clay. And being made of clay, Adam is made into a human from clay. But Eve is taken from the human. And that therefore Eve is the true mother of Christianity. It was also Hildegard, the first female mystic to see woman as an emblem of humanity and therefore as central to that. It is Mary, a female, that is chosen by Jesus, by God, for the incarnation of the Lord. It is God. He could have appeared out of the blue. There was no need of a female, and yet a female is chosen. A virgin is chosen as a source and vessel of Christ. It is also Hildegard, however, who accepts the position of women within medieval Christendom as one subordinated to the power of priests. That is to say, it is radical in one way. There is a radical element in one hand, but in the other hand, there is also playing according to the rules. This is very important because we are going to see that mystics remain orthodox as long as they do not challenge the authority of the church. That is to say, they could present very novel ideas, they could present very radical ideas, but as long as they do not conflict with the lay orthodoxies and with the strict hierarchies of power. So Hildegard is an important feminist, and that is why she has indeed come to the attention of feminist historians in the last 10 years, who have turned her into a central figure in the, shall we say, elucidation of many of the ideas about the role of women within Christianity and within the 12th century as well. But she's also a mystic. And a great deal of what she's able to say is because she has the authority of her mysticism, because it was well known not only throughout the Rhineland but throughout Western Christendom. She is such an active scholar and letter writer about her visions. Her visions come to her throughout her life. She's a prophet, a visionary. But it's not until she's 43, which is quite old by medieval standards, that she confesses these visions to the bishop in her area. And the bishop asks her to, in essentially, write down her visions. Her visions, her mystical visions, are extraordinarily cerebral and a very kind of lucid mysticism. They are very far away from the kind of childlike simplicity and charm of the Little Flowers of Francis, or from the kind of emotions and passions of Bernard. They are a very elaborate vision. It is a vision of a pillar. And she described this pillar to us. It's a huge pillar with many sides and angles, and the prophets sit in the pillar, all leading in a kind of emanation all the way to the vision of the living light. This is how she presents God, as a kind of living light at the top. And I have some excerpts here because it will give us an idea of how complex these visions are. And one of the things that some of my students have done is try to visualize this vision either through a computer model or actual painting. And it's quite science fiction-like in many respects. It is this enormous pillars with many different etches, and prophets and so on sit around these pillars. And I have, for example, one section here. And the third age, facing the south, was broad and wide in the middle, but thinner and narrow at the bottom and top, like a bow drawn and ready to shoot arrows. And at the top of the pillar I saw a light, so bright that human tongue cannot describe it. Ineffably is, cannot be described, cannot be said. And this light appeared a dove, a gold ray coming out of his mouth, which shed brilliant light on the pillar. And as I look at this, I heard from heaven a terrifying voice rebuking me and saying, "What you see is divine." And as this voice, I tremble so much that I dare not look there any longer. Then I saw inside the building a figure standing on the pavement facing this pillar, looking sometimes at it and sometimes at the people who were going to and from in the building. And that figure was so bright and glorious that I could not look at her face. It's the Virgin. Or her garments, for the splendor with which she shone, I saw only that, like the other virtues, she appeared in human form. And it goes on and goes on for many, many, many pages. And it's the way in which, in this cerebral, lucid mysticism, Hildegard presents the centrality of Mary in all these visions and the joining of Mary to God. And when we talk about Bernard right now, we are going to see how the cult of the Virgin plays an extraordinary role in the mysticism and the spirituality of the 12th century. At this point in time, I will turn around to my students and ask if they have any questions on Hildegard of Bingen. But here, essentially, we will go on to talk about Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard is the most important saint and mystic of the 12th century. He's perhaps one of the most important figures of the 12th century. Richard Southend, a great English historian who recently died, in a great book entitled The Making of the Middle Ages, calls the 12th century the century of Saint Bernard, even though Bernard dies in 1054. He was born probably in 1091 or 1090 in the area of Dijon, and at the age of 21, together with 24 friends and four brothers, he entered the monastery of Citeaux. Citeaux was a very new monastery. It was a monastery founded by a rather crazy Englishman named Stephen of Hardin. It was a place that had been created and founded to escape the corruption of the world. The great reform movements, which I discuss in the third lecture, had in a sense withered out by the end of the 12th century, by the end of the 11th century. And in the 12th century, there was a new need to withdraw from the world. So the Cistercian monasteries, Citeaux, the Cistercian order, is created in the early 12th century to withdraw from the world. They are built in isolated areas, in areas which were not inhabited. It was an attempt to recreate the desert in Northern Europe. Bernard comes to Citeaux, and within a few years, his brilliance leads him away from Citeaux to the founding of a new monastery, of which he becomes the abbot, the monastery at Clairvaux, which is why we know him as Bernard of Clairvaux. He is very much as Hildegard, an active letter writer, and he intervenes into the affairs of the world continuously. We know, for example, that he intervenes in disputes between towns, and he settles the disputes, and he's a maker of peace. We know that he preaches the Second Crusade, and that he plays an important role in the Second Crusade. We know that he forces Louis VII to divorce Eleanor of Aquitaine. We know that a decision on a papal election is given to him, and that he chooses a candidate who had the lesser amount of votes. So that is someone whose opinion is sought by the great in the land, and who plays a significant role in the world in which he lives. We know that he is the enemy of Abelard, and that he pursues Abelard continuously, and that he, in a sense, forces Abelard into a miserable life at the end to seek refuge at Cluny from the persecutions of Bernard, who argues against Abelard's positions on the Trinity and on the Christian faith. We know that he's also one of the most important mystics in the 12th century. And we know that his mysticism has a tremendous impact on the rest of Europe. Dante places Bernard right up there, close to God, in the Divine Comedy. We have this quote from Dante, which tells us a great deal of how Bernard was perceived almost 150 years after his death. "Such was I," speaking of Bernard, "gazing upon the living love of him who in this world by contemplation tasted of that peace, the peace of Christ." So when Dante in the Divine Comedy, on his way to his own mystical experience at the end of the Commedia, thinks of how you can describe the perfect mystic, it is Bernard of Clairvaux that he places right up there, close to the throne of God. So this is a very important man. And what is his mysticism all about? Bernard begins by telling us in his writing that the most important thing about being a Christian is the freedom that we have. Bernard is a supporter of the idea of the freedom of will. The freedom that we have is what is unique, what makes us truly human. But it is a freedom that is a gift of God, Bernard will argue. And because it is a gift of God, we know that we are not free. There is a contradiction here. We are free, but since the freedom is one that has been given to us, then we are not free. We owe this freedom to God's greatness, and therefore we must love God. And the first question he asked is how we must love God. And he says we must love God with all of us, with all of ourselves. We should give ourselves completely to God. Because no matter how much we love God, without any barriers, without any impediments, we will never be able to pay this great debt we owe God. But how do we really love God? And he will argue that there are, and this is a doctrine of the four loves, there are four kinds of love. The first love should be the love of God, but the first love in reality is the love of self. Look at babies. When babies are born, Bernard will tell you, they only are concerned with what? With eating and defecating. They love themselves, they love their bodies so very much. And that is the love of most people. You love yourself first and foremost. So that the love, self-love, cupiditas, the love of ourselves is the first love in fact. But then that love of self makes humans totally miserable. And therefore, you realize that you're lost in the world because no matter how much you love yourself, it's not enough. So essentially, the second step, Bernard will say, is to love God as a kind of trade-in. If I love you, God, maybe you will treat me well. The third love is when some humans begin to realize that the love of God is sweet. And the fourth love is that love in which you, in a sense, give yourself completely to God and love God for God himself or herself or itself. And that, Bernard says, very few people achieve, and that is what the mystical experience is truly all about. Let me read to you from Bernard's own words. And he says, "Fitting indeed it is that when the soul shall emerge from this school of humility," that is to say, you have to go through a process of cleansing yourself. And the cleansing yourself is a desert. It's the reading of the desert fathers. It's asceticism. It's punishing the flesh. It's following the examples of the anchorites and people who fled into the desert and who submitted their fleshes to pain and to humility and to silence and to introspection. "Fitting indeed it is that when the soul shall emerge from this school of humility, wherein under the tuition of the Son, she has learned to enter into herself in accordance with the warning, si ignoras te, te agredere e pacere a Dios tuos, if you ignore yourself, then you will be pleasing to us. Fitting it is now that under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, she be introduced through affection into the storerooms of charity, by which assuredly we must understand the hearts of her neighbors. There stay up with flowers, compass about with apples, that is to say, with good habits and holy virtues, she made, alas, fine entrance into the chamber of the King, for whose love she longs. There, when silence has been made in heaven for a space, it may be of half an hour, she rests calmly in those dear embraces, herself indeed asleep, but her heart on the watch. How, while the time lasts, she may look into the hidden secrets of truth, on whose memory she will feast as soon as she returns to herself. There she beholds things invisible and hears things that cannot be uttered, of which it is not lawful for man to speak. There are things that surpass all that knowledge which might night show it into night, yet day into day utter a speech, and is permitted to us to speak wisdom among the wise, and to express in spiritual terms those things that are spiritual." It is a chamber, it is a matrimonial bed in which the soul of man is received by the King and made into one. And then afterwards, this experience cannot be conveyed, cannot be explained. It is because Bernard is a mystic, because he argues that he has been one with God, that his soul has been united with God, that Bernard can, in many respects, lead the Cistercians into one of the most prominent orders in the 12th century. It is Bernard who, in a sense, and the Cistercians as a whole, who push for the new architectural style, the Gothic, that reflects the greatness of God, not the enclosed sense of the Romanesque, but the Gothic that, in a sense, reaches out to the immensity of God, to something that is ineffable and unreachable. It is also Bernard that in many respects paralleling the teachings of courtly love is one of the promoters of the cult of the Virgin Mary. Mary had played a very small role in the liturgy and in the religion of the Middle Ages. It is not until the 12th century, with this revival of mysticism and with the growth of courtly love, that Mary becomes essentially the center of the new spirituality, which is why all those Gothic cathedrals that begin to, in a sense, go up in the 12th century, as Bernard wrote these words, are all dedicated to the Lady. And therefore, there is an element of the feminization of religion that occurs in the 12th century, which is reflected in the cult of the Virgin, in the mysticism of Hildegard, but also in the writings of Bernard, for whom the soul and the mystic is always female as enters into a union with God. Thank you.